This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
The Night Sky, November 2012. Well, after the sun has set, over in the west, we see that lovely group of constellations, Cygnus the Swan, Lyra the Lyre, and Aquila the Eagle. They are three bright stars, Deneb, Vega, and Altair, making up what's called the summer triangle, but still quite visible, quite late into the autumn. But moving over towards the south, we have quite a large constellation, that of Pegasus, the winged horse. It's actually upside down, as seen from the northern hemisphere. Four stars make up the great square of Pegasus, and quite a good way of judging how dark and transparent your sky is to count how many stars you can see within the square. I'm lucky if I can do more than five, but younger people and darker skies can see many more than that. Below that is in fact a very faint constellation called Pisces, the Fishes. And up to the left of Pegasus is Andromeda. And in the night sky page, just Google that, I have a little chart to show you how to find Andromeda, starting, it's called star hopping, from the star Alpheratz, which is the top left-hand corner of the square of Pegasus, and moving up and then to the right. If it's clear, and around new moon, about November the 12th, you've got some chance of actually leaving Andromeda, working your way back down, crossing the route you came, and carrying on to find M33, which is the third largest galaxy in our local group, Andromeda being number one, our own Milky Way galaxy being number two, and M33 being number three. Moving further over, we have high up in the sky Cassiopeia, and following below that, we have the constellation of Perseus. Two nice things in Perseus. In the region between Cassiopeia and Perseus, along the arc of the Milky Way, lies the double cluster. It's a wonderful object in binoculars or a small telescope. One of the beauties of the sky, I think. And there's a rather nice star in Perseus called Algol, the demon star. It's actually an occulting binary, and every few days its brightness drops quite considerably before rising again. That's worth looking out for. Further over, rising up in the east, we have this other wonderful region of the sky. The brightest star is Capella in Auriga. Again, that constellation lies along the Milky Way. It contains quite a number of what are called open clusters, young groupings of stars, and they can be picked up with binoculars. You'll also see the nearest open cluster to us, the Pleiades cluster, or one of the nearest, beautiful object. And that is in Taurus the Bull. It has the bright star Aldebaran, the Eye of the Bull, which is actually halfway between ourselves and what is called the Hyades cluster. So it's actually an interloper. But there's another interloper there at the moment this month, as we'll see later, and that is the bright planet Jupiter. As the evening wears on, so Orion will rise. The three stars making up his belt will point down to the left to Sirius, but that won't rise till sometime later. Below the belt, though, you might spot a misty patch. That is the Great Orion Nebula, a region of star formation, where stars, like our sun, are being born as we speak. And finally, going over slightly to the north of east, Gemini will be rising, its two bright stars, Castor and Pollux. So, a lot to see, and of course, we now have many more hours of darkness in which to see them. What about the planets? Well, I've already mentioned Jupiter. It rises about 8 p.m. at the beginning of November, and in fact, during twilight by the end of the month. Because it's now in quite a high part of the ecliptic, when it's due south, it's actually some 60 degrees elevation above much of the murk we have in our atmosphere. So our viewing conditions for Jupiter this year and next year are probably the best they'll be and have been for some time. It starts the month lying just 7 degrees to the upper left of the star Aldebaran. Is actually moving westwards in the sky in what is called retrograde motion and carries on doing so until the beginning of February. So its brightness increases very slightly and it moves slightly closer and above Aldebaran during the month. With an angular size of nearly 48 arc seconds by the end of the month, there's lots of detail visible, and I can't think of a better reason for for buying a small telescope to have a look at Jupiter and, of course, its four lovely Galilean moons, which we see weaving their way around it. Now, Saturn, it passed behind the Sun on the 25th of October, and it's still pretty close. It's just 6 degrees away from the Sun as November begins, which means, of course, it's totally lost in the Sun's glare. But during the month, the separation, the elongation, as they say, increases to about 32 degrees. So by the end of the month, it will rise 3 hours before sunrise and will be visible above the eastern horizon. In the first couple of those weeks, you'll probably need binoculars to pick it up, but later on, it should be quite easy to see. And the really nice thing to say about Saturn is that the rings are opening out. They're now about 18 degrees to the line of sight. You may remember a year or so ago, they were edge on. You couldn't see them at all. So when it's reasonably high in elevation, it might take a while to do that. We have a reasonable chance of seeing Cassini's division in the ring system. Something to look out for with a small telescope. You should also be able to spot Saturn's brightest and largest satellite called Titan. Well, Mercury, on the other hand, passes in front of the Sun, that's called inferior conjunction, on November the 17th. So in fact, we can't see it until the very end of the month, when it may be spotted down to the lower left of Saturn and Venus. And again, on the night sky page, that is one of the highlights. So at the very end of the month, in fact, is risen to magnitude minus 0.3, so reasonably bright. Mars has been hanging around in the western sky for ages now, quite low. It's sort of moving eastwards, and that means it's still visible. It's actually now in Ophiuchus, and that's probably not a constellation you're well aware of, and it goes into Sagittarius on the 27th. It's visible low in the west after sunset, with a magnitude of about plus 1.2. However, its angular size is just over 4 arc seconds, so you'll see no details, I think, on its salmon pink disk. And finally, Venus. Well, it rises about 3 hours before the Sun, and honestly, with a magnitude of minus 4, it completely dominates the pre-dawn sky. If you've just looked out over towards the east before dawn, you just can't fail to spot it. During November, it's actually getting smaller in terms of its angular size, but at the same time, the percentage that's illuminated is increasing, from 81 to 88% as it happens. And that actually means that the brightness barely changes from minus 4.0 to minus 3.9 magnitudes. So in fact, we can see all the planets, the major planets this month. And in fact, I've also given you some details of how to find Neptune on the night sky page. Well, finally, the highlights of the month. Well, I have to say that November is the first of probably three great months during which to view Jupiter. As I said, it's in Taurus, high in the ecliptic, and fairly high in the sky when it's in the south. It's looking a bit different than it has been for a while. The North Equatorial Belt has actually become quite broad. The Great Red Spot is sort of a pale shade of pink, but you can sort of see it against the South Equatorial Belt. I've given you a list of when that Great Red Spot is roughly facing us on the meridian in the evening. There's probably about 10 or 11 of those, a good chance to have a look for the Great Red Spot. And for those that do any imaging, there's a nice opportunity at the end of November when, in fact, during complete darkness, you could actually image during a complete rotation of Jupiter. And I have seen people who've made wonderful movies just showing the planet rotating. So perhaps we'll see some more of those sometime in the spring. But you can see Mars. November the 16th after sunset might be a good time to try. It's seen below a nice thin crescent moon in the southwestern sky. You can search for Neptune, best around the 10th to the 15th of November, because that's around new moon, so the skies will be quite dark. It lies in Aquarius, and again, there's a chart to show you where it is. Not that obvious. A go-to telescope is a good thing to find, to help find it. But if you do, you may just spot a sort of a darkish bluish disk. We have a meteor shower this month. Probably one of the two best. It's called the Leonids, and that's on the 16th and 17th. And if you've been listening, you'll be aware that that's just after new moon. So the light from the moon is not going to get in the way. The meteors come from the comet Temple-Tuttle, and we sometimes get some really nice events, even a meteor storm. One is not predicted, I might say, this year. That about every 33 years, which is to do with the orbital period of the comet, when we might get something rather good. This year, perhaps not. But nevertheless, you probably ought to see 20 meteors an hour. And as the Leonid name implies, the radiant from where the meteors seem to diverge is in the constellation of Leo, the lion. So you have to wait up really till after midnight. And that's always when it's best to observe meteor showers, because then the Earth is facing the direction where the meteors come from. At the very end of the month, there are a couple of things we can look for. On the 27th, at dawn, just before dawn, Venus and Saturn, just 0.8 degrees between them. It's a very nice grouping. They differ in brightness on that day by 4.6 magnitudes. So that Venus will be almost 100 times brighter than Saturn. On November the 28th, after sunset, you can actually see Jupiter and a full moon. Jupiter will be rising close to the moon, and the moon will have risen just a few hours earlier. One last thing. On the very end of November, the 30th, Mercury is near its greatest elongation, and if you could look out to the east on a clear morning before dawn, you'll actually see Saturn highest up, then Venus, the brightest, and then Mercury lined up in the eastern sky. Mercury, with a magnitude of minus 0.2, will probably be seen as its best for some time. So quite a nice lot of things to look at during the month. I do hope you enjoy and have plenty of dark skies.
Thanks for that, Ian. And now here's John Field with what you can see in the Southern Hemisphere's night sky.
Kia ora and welcome to the November Jodcast, coming to you from Carter Observatory, Wellington, New Zealand. In our evening sky, the winter constellations of Scorpius and Sagittarius are disappearing in our twilight sky in the west, heralding the arrival of our summer evenings. Mercury will be in the western sky after sunset during the early part of November, below Antares, and by the middle of the month, it will have moved into the twilight sky and will be difficult to spot. Mars is higher up, past Antares, and is moving in front of the stars forming Ophiuchus, the serpent barrier. This constellation sits between Scorpius and Sagittarius. Ophiuchus is sometimes called the coffin, as its five brightest stars form a coffin-like shape. Two globular clusters, M10 and 12, can be found within 3 degrees of each other in Ophiuchus. At magnitude 6.4 and 7.6, the first should be visible in binoculars, whilst the second will need a good sky. Opposite Taurus, Orion and Canis Major are climbing into the eastern sky, providing a variety of new targets following our winter constellations. These constellations will be visible throughout our November nights. The three brightest stars in our sky, Sirius, Canopus and Alpha Centauri, can be found spread along our southeastern horizon, forming a flattened triangle. Sirius, the brightest of the three stars, is in the east. It is the brightest star in the constellation of Canis Major, the large dog. To us in the southern hemisphere, the dog lies upside down in our night sky, so we see him lying on his back with his feet up in the air. Sirius marks the front of the dog. To the northeast of Sirius we find the constellation of Taurus the Bull and Orion the Hunter. The face of Taurus is outlined by the V-shaped asterisk on the stars known as the Hyades cluster. In Greek mythology, the Hyades were the five daughters of Atlas and half-sisters to the Pleiades. The brightest star in this group is Orange Aldebaran, the name meaning the follower in Arabic, and this came about as a star follows the Pleiades across the sky. Aldebaran is actually a foreground star 65 light years away, whilst the other stars in the V are about 153 light years away. Taurus's long horns extend downwards towards our northern horizon. Jupiter sits between Aldebaran, the brightest star in Taurus, and Alnaf, the second brightest star, the brighter of the two horn tips, appearing as a brilliant white star. Jupiter will be high in the northern sky by midnight. Jupiter will be at its best at opposition, closest to the Earth, in early December, and will appear at its brightest during this time in our sky. Binoculars and small telescopes will reveal Jupiter's four largest moons, which will change position from night to night. Near to the fainter tip of the two horns, small telescopes will reveal the faint smudge of light called M1. Or more commonly, the Crab Nebula. This expanding cloud of dust and gas is a result of a supernova that was observed in 1054. Visible as a dim haze in binoculars, a 100mm or greater telescope will begin to reveal more of its shape and detail. The Crab Nebula marks the end of a star's life, whilst the Pleiades cluster marking Taurus's back are youthful stars. Also known as the Seven Sisters, Matariki and Subaru, along with many other names, they feature in the star lore of many cultures in both hemispheres. Many see only six stars or less due to light pollution. Away from city lights, the number increases to over 12. The cluster is about 440 light years away, and its brightest stars are over 200 times brighter than our Sun. Their age has been estimated to be about 100 million years old, a blink in the life of many stars. Sitting along the ecliptic, the Moon, Sun, and planets can pass near or in front of the Pleiades, creating a stunning sight. East from Taurus, we find Orion hanging upside down. He has his shield raised towards Taurus and a club above his head. A line of three stars marks his belt. A second line of faint stars above and to the right of the belt forms his sword. You may be able to see a faint haze in the Sword of Orion, known as the Great Nebula in Orion. It is a vast star-forming region about 1,200 light-years away. Binoculars and small telescopes will reveal more detail. Large telescopes will show many faint tendrils of gas and many faint stars in and around the nebula. To most Southern Hemisphere star watchers, the belt and sword form the pot, or the saucepan. To Māori, the three stars are known as Tau Tauro. Moving further to the south, we find Canopus sitting aside the Milky Way. The second brightest star in our night sky is in fact the brightest within 1,000 light-years of our solar system. Moving along the Milky Way, we find Alpha Centauri. The third brightest star is one of the two pointer stars, the other being the nearby bright star Beta Centauri, that points towards the Southern Cross, or Crux. Appearing in the shape of a diamond kite, it can be found in the southwestern sky after sunset, sitting between Canopus and Alpha Centauri. It will get progressively lower in our evening sky before climbing higher in the southeast after midnight. With a declination of minus 60, Crux will never set in New Zealand and can be seen as far north as plus 20, where it is visible along the southern horizon during May. Until about 6,000 years ago, it would have been visible from southern Britain, but due to precession, this group of stars has been lost from view. Nearby to Crux, you can find the Diamond and False Crosses that are not true constellations but are asterisms, easily seen patterns in the sky. This month, Australia, New Zealand and most of the South Pacific Islands are treated to a solar eclipse on the 14th of November, and it is a total eclipse in a thin band across northern Australia. The cities of Cairns and Port Douglas will have just over 2 minutes of totality at 6:39 in the morning, and then the path travels inland through the sparsely populated outback. Either side of the central eclipse, path observers will get to see a less spectacular partial eclipse. All of New Zealand will see a partial eclipse. From North Cape, about 91% of the sun will be covered, and from Invercargill, only 58% will be covered. For us, maximum eclipse time is at 10:36 in the morning. When observing a partial solar eclipse, you must use proper solar filters. Any viewing with normal sunglasses, binoculars or telescope will lead to permanent eye damage. Astronomical societies and many observatories will be selling solar eclipse glasses or running observing events and will have specific times for your locations. Only during the total part of the eclipse is it safe to observe with the unaided eye. At this time you may be able to see the faint pearly glow of the corona. Some bright stars and planets may be seen as well. On the morning of the 29th of November, the full moon will move through the Earth's shadow and a lunar eclipse will be seen. This eclipse will not be very impressive as the moon will not appreciably move through the deepest part of the shadow called the umbra, and maximum is at 3:31 a.m, not a very sociable time. From the team here at Cardo, we wish you well and we wish you clear skies and great observing.